All right, let's call the Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:34. Today is I think 36th day, something like that.
37.
Sorry, thank you. We have Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Coggio. This is Judiciary Committee. Today, my intention is my plan is to bring up Senate Joint Resolution 21. I know Justice Carpinetti came last time, and I wanted to give him a few minutes to testify today. I know that some of the members have questions of the Judicial Council, and I wanted to give Senator Kelly ample time. So my intention is to get this public testimony rapidly, ask questions that we need to get on the record from those present. Give the sponsor ample opportunity to respond to some of those questions, and then get this up for debate, amendment, or however you want to proceed. And my intention is to bring it up for a vote today. But we do have Justice Carpinetti here today, and I'll give him an opportunity. Also, Senator Olson has SB 136, which is unmanned aerial vehicles that I want him to introduce today. And for the committee's instructions, we're going to hear members of the Ethics Committee that want to serve our Ethics Committee, and I'd like to have plenty of time to ask them questions, thank them for their willingness to serve. And then should we have time, I'd like for Senator Dyson to bring up 108 for some further discussion at this point. And that will bring us probably to our 3 o'clock hour. That's a lot to do in one session here. So with that, I know Mr. Carpinetti, you came to speak to SJR 21, and I did come on up and put yourself on the record. I do ask if you would kind of keep it concise. We had several members of both the judicial branch, including chief justices, speak, but you're a highly regarded man, and yes, I have. So I would ask if you could keep it concise. I would appreciate that. And if I feel that it's just taking up time, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up. But you're a huge respected person here in this committee, so thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm forewarned. I appreciate that. First, thanks to the chair and to all the members of the committee for taking so much time on such an important issue. Second, I would mainly like to answer questions you might have because you've heard a lot of testimony, and if there's any answers that I can provide from my perspective, I would like to do that. Okay. Third, I'd like to make 3 points briefly. And I should say at the outset, I appreciate the respect in the term Justice Carpinetti. I am not only retired, I'm not serving pro tem, I am Citizen Carpinetti. So I don't object to the title, but I want it really clear. I'm not speaking for the court system, and I am not a judge anymore. I'm a retired judge. Mm-hmm. And personally, that means a lot to me because I can do a lot of things now I couldn't do before. I can, you know, raise money. I'm going to do that. I'm going to work on the Juno the Willoughby Arts Complex. You may all be receiving a telephone call from me in the next 3 months. So,
We'll be forewarned.
Yeah, so you're forewarned as well. I think that's important to say at the outset.
Thank you.
So 3 points. First, I would urge the point that there's no demonstrated need for a change. And when I wrote my letter to you, I said I couldn't find a sponsor statement. Apparently it came out the same day I wrote the letter. I'd like to talk just very briefly about that. The second point is that the present system balances with great sensitivity the competing interests, and I think you want to be really careful before you tinker with that, before you change that, because there may be consequences that are bad and there may be consequences that are unintended. And the third is that the proposal creates a lot of problems. I'm not going to say anything more about that. I set them out in the letter, and I think they're all mm-hmm. true, and I think that you need to consider them and make sure that you've got a good answer for them. But the first one is the no demonstrated need for a change. I can't emphasize too much that our Constitution is widely respected in this country. We have a 55-year history with that Constitution. It's been amended 28 times, so it's once every couple of years, and a lot of those have been very technical, going from Secretary of State to Lieutenant Governor as a title, that sort of thing. The number of substantive amendments are substantially less. So I looked first to the sponsor statement to try to figure out why are we going to do this. The first thing that's mentioned is a number of other states do this. It's not the majority of other states, but a number of other states. I don't think that's any reason at all. It's a common phrase in Alaska. We don't give a damn how they do it outside. And sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. What I would urge you to do is look for positive reasons, not that some other states, not the majority, but some other states have a majority of citizen members, but a positive reason. The second reason stated was that the state is growing. The state is growing. The state is growing, but we haven't increased the size of the legislature. The reapportionment board is still five. I mean, you need to have a specific reason why there is a problem with the present system before you would change it, I would think. The third reason that was given is regional diversity. And frankly, I don't really understand that. The Constitution requires that the governor make appointments with due regard for regional diversity, and the governors do that. And we have people that represent the state from all over. The fourth reason was to reduce the likelihood of tie votes. And honestly, I think the facts just belie the importance of this. First, it happens really infrequently. You know that from 1984 to 2013, 30 years, over 1,100 votes, there were 68 times that the Chief Justice had to vote. So less than 6% of the time do you even have a tie vote situation. And the real bugaboo, I think, the thing that's really a problem and that applies to this proposed amendment is when all the public members are on one side and all the lawyers are on the other side. Then you might say, well, is it really a problem? That's happened 15 times in our history. That's about 1% of the votes, and the Chief Justice sides with the lawyers only slightly more than when the Chief Justice sides with the non-lawyers, with the public members. So looking at the big picture, it seems like a really unpersuasive case to me to say we've got to change our system that has worked well for 55 years because there's been 15-3-3 tie votes with one on one side, with all the lawyers on one side and all the public members on the other. And I want to talk about that a little bit more, but I don't think that that's a problem for the Chief Justice. The final statement in the sponsor statement is avoid conflicts of interest, but there's no conflict of interest for a Chief Justice to break a tie. There's no conflict for a Supreme Court member to break a tie against a sitting Superior Court judge or Court of Appeals judge. I mean, our business is to review their work. We affirm them sometimes, we reverse them sometimes. I just don't understand the statement that there's a conflict of interest in the Chief Justice's job in doing this. So I honestly don't see the reasons there that amount to a reason to change our Constitution. But to me, what's really missing is some statement that this system is broken. This system is not working. We have too many judges being indicted for corruption. We have too many judges who are taking kickbacks. We have judges going, we don't have that. We enjoy a very happy history in terms of judicial performance, in my view. I know I'm biased. I know I spent 30 plus years on the bench. But I really challenge anyone who's supporting this to give a positive reason as to how it is that our judiciary is failing in terms of the things that I think are important. And so I don't think that the need to change has been demonstrated. Now, I want to talk for just a moment, and I hadn't planned to, but then I heard Mr. Pauly, who I thought gave a pretty persuasive presentation the other day. I won't say ultimately persuasive because I disagree with him, but I thought he made some good points. But he attacked this issue that it happens so rarely, and what he said was, well, the opponents say that it happens rarely, but that's not really true. Two of the five seats on the current court are held by people who came through a council in which there was a 3-3 tie, all the lawyers on one side, all the public members on the other, and the Chief Justice voted no. And that's true. It has happened twice in the last 2 years. I went back and looked at those votes. I wasn't involved in one of them. In the vote that I was not involved in, there were 12 people that applied to go to the governor, and four nominees were sent. That seems like a pretty good number to send a third of the applicants to the highest court in the state. The other one is not so favorable from my point of view, and that is there were 12 applicants that time also, and only two went. I know intimately about that because I was the Chief Justice there, and I was the person that cast a no vote, and it was a judge who had three yes votes and three no votes. And I will tell you what I told that judge, because I called him afterwards and told him. I told him, first of all, it was the hardest decision I ever had to make because I think he's a qualified judge, and I think he could do the job on the Supreme Court. And, in fact, the first time that I was on the council that, and the only other time that a Supreme Court position came up, his name, he applied to the council, and his name was sent to the governor. That was a time Mr. Pauley didn't talk about. There were 25 applicants that time, 17 interviewed, 8 withdrew. So out of 17, we sent 7 names to the governor. That's a very different situation. And the judge who didn't make it this last time did go through. And I had no problem with him going through. And you might say, this doesn't make any sense. He applies, he goes one time, he applies a couple of years later or a year later. He doesn't go. What's the answer? And the answer is in the Constitution. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention, the framers, talked about a council that would be involved, would be made up of lawyers who really knew the other lawyers and knew the ones that were good and knew the ones that were bad, and public members that could kind of act as a check and give the broader everyman's view, good people that would come together and try to make these decisions. And they were charged with sending the absolute best that they could find, charged with sending the tallest timber. And when you look at it that way, that you're trying to do what the framers said, it is not inconsistent that a particular person can be among the best if the best is expanded to 7 out of 16, which it was that earlier time because there was a lot that was in a really good group, and might not make it out of 12 when there's 2 that are standing head and shoulders above the rest. And that's what I told my colleague. I said these 2 were head and shoulders in the view of, in my view, because I'm casting this vote and I'm responsible for it, these 2 were head and shoulders. They're not just their bar polls and not just their interviews, which were spectacular, but in any event, that's the answer to that. And I hope that the committee takes into consideration the question of whether or not the council has failed in the past in deciding to change a constitution that has served us so well. I had some other things, but I know that you're
I know,
you're
busy, and I was going to ask you to wrap up anyway. And to be in fairness, because we needed to understand, and I think the public record and the people listening in need to hear how the system works. But to be fair, I have allowed probably nearly 3 hours of testimony from those within the system. Have purposefully not made it a political issue of just getting names out. So I think I've been fairly generous in creating that record. And so at this point, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the committee. I know the committee had a question once more of the Judicial Council. I sure appreciate you taking the time to come out. I know that you wrote a letter and sat through the whole last meeting, so thank you very much, and really appreciate you taking your time to come here and look for your retirement to be a fun one. So, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I once asked the head of the university, it seems like the values that many of the professors don't are not the same as the values of the culture and the people that pay support the system. And he said it's a culture there that's quite confident that their worldview and their values is the only correct one, and they would consider it a moral anathema to not hire people that share that worldview, which is, you know, and it's a very difficult one. There are some of our constituents out there that believe, perhaps wrongly, that the Bar Association is kind of a collective or corporate assumption of some values, perhaps they're not clear in the Constitution, and that they consciously or unconsciously want to perpetuate that perspective, and then that's what makes the process suboptimal. And my guess is there's great flaws with that perception, but would you just for a minute or two rebut that argument?
Sure. And I'll do it by kind of admitting at the outset that I am occasionally ashamed of my colleagues in the Bar Association when I see votes that I think are not true to the oath that we all sign. Because I sometimes see people get scores that I can't believe that they're, at least with regard to legal competence, they wouldn't have gotten higher scores. So I want to state at the outset that I'm not defending 4,000 lawyers in the way they vote in every poll, and they probably think the same of me and some of my opinions. Thank you very much. But I will say this. 99% of the cases that come before all the courts have nothing to do with political issues. They have to do with figuring out what you all meant when you passed legislation, figuring what the framers meant when they put these principles into the Constitution, figuring out how regulations fit with statutes. I mean, most of the time, judges, even the judges on the Supreme Court, are not working with a blank slate. They're working with texts, and they're trying to figure out what they mean. And what lawyers want is people on the bench who are going to do their homework, who are going to read the briefs, who are going to read the statutes, who are going to puzzle it out, who don't come with a pre-fixed idea. And what worries me is that if you tinker with the two-part system that we have now, where the first part is supposed to be, and I think generally is, merit-based, and the second part is supposed to be and is more attuned to political realities. And by the way, I use the word political with all respect. I do not use it as a derogatory term, and I think people that do all of us a disservice. But there is a place for politics in the selection of judges, but it's the second step. It's when the governor decides.
If we could keep these brief.
Sorry.
Let me.
You know,
what I'm doing, I'm trying to allow the sponsor an opportunity to have time to respond, and I will keep a lid on it if I have to. And if the questions are going to go to retired Judge Carpinetti, then maybe I won't have time to get to the counsel that I think some people wanted to ask. But if it looks like we're just going to ask the questions and run my committee out of other business, then I'm going to have trouble. All right, so Senator Dyson.
Yeah, case in point, the issue of abortion is it's a question, is that human rights or some kind of a peculiar moral religious one? So there's a judge or a lawyer in this state who has litigated a couple of the abortion-related things. I think he got someone went all the way to the Supreme Court and did so quite successfully, and I understand very well respected. He's never got past the process there, and there's great concern in those of us who are concerned about human rights, very analogous to the slavery battle, you know, and so on. And there's certainly a perception of people share my perspective of human rights that a warrior on our side, or a guy at least who has taken on some of those cases, will never get through the judicial council.
I think you have to look at the whole record in that case, and you have to decide whether you want a warrior, an incredibly strong advocate on the bench, a person who has taken numerous public positions on issues that come before courts all the time, or whether you don't. And I think the reason that the person of whom you speak, I mean, I was on the council twice. He never came to me for a tie-breaking vote because he couldn't get even three votes.
But Mr. Carpinetti, with all due respect, though, we've had judges who have gone as heads of Planned Parenthood talking about the contentious issue who went sailing through. And so I think they took very strong positions as well, and yet did not get near the challenge. So that's the perception that we see from our end of the world.
I wasn't on the council during any of those other times. I can only speak to the times when I was on.
I do need to move along. And sure. So I wanted to at least show that this is a perspective that some of us feel. And I will say this for those who are listening, sitting right here at this desk with lawyers questioning public members in a very vitriolic manner, cross-examining them for their political activity, trying to make them, in fact, one of them actually withdrew their name because they were making it such a political hot issue. And it's not unlike the judge who just called in the last meeting and impugned our motives to the highest degree, a sitting judge. So to think that that arrogance is going to be met with a soft hand, I think, is tough for us. So you can see, I want you to see the thing that we bristle at, too.
Right.
So we have questions. Senator Liesl McGuire.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Justice Carpinetti, I want to say thank you for testifying, and thank you for your service to our state on the bench. You've been a very distinguished justice, and I want to say that I apologize that you're coming before the committee at a time where there's time constraint, because you deserve a lot of respect. and I don't want you to feel as if there's not respect for you.
I've never felt that.
So I want to say that. And I want to publicly thank you. Something that I don't know if you were here on the day that I said it, but when I said my comments about why I liked the idea of adding more public members, but wanted to change it to not 10, but to reduce it down, I actually used your example. And I don't know that you were here for it, but I just wanted to say it again on the record, which was that in the majority of cases, when you were the Supreme Court Justice Chair, you would tie break on the side of the public, and you were very consistent about that. And I want to say thank you for that, because I talked about the fact that I didn't ever want to move to a place where we had publicly elected judges because of the potential for corruption and the appearance, if not reality, of impropriety with that system. And that I think it's very important that when we have murmurs that come up in the public about concerns of how we select our judges, that we respond to that, even if we don't necessarily agree, that it's important. And I think that this bill is very important, because there are people out there that feel over the last, in particular, 4 years, that there has been a collective rejection of the public side in the selection. And I think it's important that we respond to that. And I think that there are other states that weigh the public membership more heavily. And I think this is a calculated way that is not going too far in doing that. And I guess my question for you is, what would be the harm in adding more public members in this bill? What would be that harm? And I guess just weighing against that, your very calculated choice as the Supreme Court Justice in those cases where you did see divisions of siding with the public members. And I think you must have had wisdom in doing that. What would be the danger in adding more public members?
Well, two questions. Okay. Going back to the cases in which I broke a 3-3 even tie in favor of sending the person up, it was because I thought in each case this person fits in the group of the best qualified. I mean, this person is not notably less qualified than others that are going to go up, and so I sent them up. The one time when I couldn't come to that conclusion, I voted no. The greater question is, what would be the harm? And I guess what I worry about is, I'm sort of conservative at heart in terms of, I like when systems work, I don't like to change them unless I can see a real need to. And what I'm worried about is that we move to a system in which the knowledge and the expertise and the experience of people who have worked day in and day out with their colleagues comes to count for very little in the selection of judges. And if that happens, there's a risk that what fills that place is not only people that don't know these people very well, that haven't had the opportunity of working with them, but people who are looking for judges who are going to give a particular result. And I really can't emphasize enough that it's really important that you put people on the bench that don't have preconceived notions. And I just worry that if we have an even balance between all the lawyerly qualities of, you know, fairness and integrity and good judgment and legal competence, and that people that have proved it, if you balance that with the public input of wanting to represent the public as a whole in picking these public officials, it's a system that's worked well. Now, if you don't feel that it's worked well, then I guess the risk of changing it becomes lesser. But I don't know. I'm debating giving you an anecdote. I will tell you this anecdote if I can. I was in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and I was working with somebody on a completely unrelated issue, and he said, "How's Justice X?" I knew him about 30 years ago, before law. "Is he still conservative?" And I was shocked by that question. Not because I think him conservative or not conservative. I was shocked by that question because I did not know the answer. And I started fumbling around about, you know, well, he reads the record really carefully. Ever seen anybody read the record that carefully? He does this, he does that. And then later I thought, I have nothing to apologize for. I should not be embarrassed that I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if he voted for Governor Romney or President Obama. I don't know what he thinks about the issues of the day. I do know he's a terrific justice. And I think only in a system like ours, where we don't talk about things like that, where they don't get pushed around the table, they don't get debated, and we try to look at the five things we're supposed to look at, that you could have somebody who's been on a court with somebody for a number of years, and not be able to answer that question and sort of be shocked by that the question was asked and that he wasn't able to answer. And I think it's because we have this kind of system. And once you start moving the political part of the selection earlier into the merit selection, then it's dangerous. That's my feeling. You'll make your own call, but that's my feeling.
Thank you. I knew that having you here in front of the committee was going to be tough to manage time-wise. But
I'm sorry.
I have Senator Wilkowski and then Senator Dyson once.
I don't have any questions.
Okay. All right. Senator Dyson.
I'm reacting. So when, probably in that context, you're asking about whether a judge is conservative or not. We're really talking about strict constructionists or not, in my view. And so a judge that read our fairly good privacy clause and said that gives the right for children to get abortions without the knowledge of their parents, and somehow or the other, in contrast to all other medical things, the right to privacy it means that somehow or the other, if you want to be not pregnant, you have the right to do so and even get the public to pay for it without the parents knowing, is, I don't know if that's conservative or traditional, but I can't imagine that that kind of a view of our law and the Constitution, I wouldn't call it political, I'd call it principled, or believing in some kind of transcendent truth. You know, the same what in the slavery battle, you know, what would you would not put anybody on the court who thought Dred Scott stunk? You know, I would hope we could. And but as I'm understanding what you're saying, that's political, and what we're looking for is technicians. And please understand what I just said is respectful.
Well, I'm comfortable in answering the question because on that particular issue, I think you know how I came out. I mean, I was on your side on that one.
Yes.
But I can't tell you how much I respect my colleagues who are on the other side and the process by which they got there. And I think that our state is better off with a process that doesn't examine people, doesn't give them tests before they go on, doesn't try to find out how they want to vote, because the essence of judging, the essence of the law, is to take the law that's been established by others and apply it to individual cases. And if you announce your results before the case even comes up before you, it's not a legal system. It's just not a legal system. Well, it's a legal system, but it's one that I don't think is as good.
I think you managed to lift a question out of Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Do you, in the times that you've been involved in the Judicial Council, does the Judicial Council even consider social issues, abortion, gay right? I mean, do you even ask those questions? Do you even try to figure out where people stand on those issues when you're evaluating them?
No.
Do you think it's appropriate to even do that?
I don't think it's appropriate. I mean, if I'd been asked the question on the Planned Parenthood parental consent case in 1997 or 98 when I was applying, I don't know how I would have answered. I would have answered something, I presume. Maybe I would have said I can't do that. But if I'd said something, then I would have been bound by it. Then 8 or 9 years later when the case came up, I would have had two things to worry about. One, what did the law say and everything else? And then what had I said before, and am I going to be lying? I just think judges shouldn't commit themselves before cases come to them. You should, and it's hard at times, and you don't want to feel like you're a complete boob walking around with no ideas in your head, and you do have ideas, but I don't think you should commit yourself, because I think it does a disservice to the litigants. I don't know what I would have said, but I might have said, oh, well, I think, you know, right to privacy, blah, blah, blah. But when I got through looking at everything, I came out the other way. Justice Matthews came out the other way. And I don't think it's right to ask on either side, and that's what I'm afraid moving the political part of the process earlier on is not a good idea.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Carpinetti, for coming out this afternoon. I guess I take issue with your statement that the ties have only slightly been more, that the justice has broken the tie and voted with one side or the other. In looking at what the numbers have been given to me, there have been 15 times in the last 30 years or so. 10 of those times the justice has joined with the attorneys on the Judicial Council. 5 of those times has they've been with the public members. So that's a 2-to-1 type of ratio that I see. So it's not slightly more. What's even more troubling is that within the last 2 years, there's been 4 or 5 times where the Chief Justice has always gone with the attorneys that are on the bar, on the bench. And if you got different numbers, I would say that I take issue with that.
Well, can but I say this? If it's sure. If it's 10 to 5 instead of 9 to 6, which is what I thought it was, then I'll stand corrected. I'm pretty certain it's not 4 or 5 times, all the times in the last 5 years, because there were 3 times, to my memory, when there was an even split, and 2 of those 3 times I voted to send a person on who had 3 yes votes from the public and 3 no votes from the lawyer. That's my recollection, that I did that, that I voted 2 times to do that, and I did it, I voted 1 time not to send the person on. So it's not all the times in the last 4 years, because I was chair from 2009 to 2012, but I stand corrected on the first one if it's that way. But my greater point is that it's a very small percentage out of 1,163 votes.
Well, I don't think that those judges that were up for appointment to this, up for the court were thinking that was a it was 100% for them.
Well, that's true.
So, but be that as it may, one other yes or just a yes or no answer. If for some reason, why don't we just take the Chief Justice out, put an amendment to the bill, to put an amendment on the resolution, take the Chief Justice completely out of there. If it's a 3-to-3 vote, goes up to the governor, let the governor decide. Now that's what a bar member actually told me that what his thoughts on the idea of breaking the tie would be, let it automatically go up, let the governor decide.
I mean,
yes or no, in favor or not? We're not answering that. Here's what my real problem is. As I look at the whole thing, the judicial aspect or branch of our government here is that what I see in the prisons is an overrepresentation of Native people. An overrepresentation. In fact, by 2016, we were told that we're going to need another Goose Creek prison, and I can tell you that that place is going to be filled with Native people as well. Why is it that more Natives are going to jail? Now, we can come out with all kinds of reasons, but let's start going down the way. How many Native judges have ever been out there? There's been one. 1975, Roy Matson, out of Kodiak, retired. Only one in the state of Alaska. In the 55-year period, only one. That I see as a problem. Let's go back down. Judicial Council. There's a problem there. I see that, for one, as you look at the Judicial Council, the public members, and I understand that the governor does whatever else. We can make all kinds of excuses why they're there. There's been only one rural Native. That was Okakuk out of 1985, served till later on. But before that, the only one out of my district was John Cross in 1961. I see an issue with the problem there of what the makeup is. Now we can go back to the Constitution and just say, you know, and you even made a reference to that. I guess that's where my problem coming in is that there's a disenfranchised rural person, rural membership that say, you know, gee, it's out of our hands. We're going to get all these people. And as you look at the lawyers that are, and I realize that there are a limited number out there, but there are numbers out there. As you look at the Judicial Council, the attorneys that are there, the 40 or so that are there, all come from Fairbanks or Anchorage. 10 of them come from Juneau, and a smattering of 3 or 4 come out of Ketchikan. What happened to the rest of the state? That's where I see the problem is. Am I wrong in my supposition?
Well, the issue of Native representation across the board has been a big one for a long time. I will say that, and this isn't the Judicial Council, but it's the court system, has been working hard with out-of-state law schools trying to interest them to come here to set up programs that would draw people in from the rural areas. And Seattle Law School is now doing that, because we're not going to get Native judges until we get Native lawyers, and we're not going to get Native lawyers until we start having Natives going to law school. And the court's been working at that, but I think that's kind of a broader discussion.
Registered Native lawyers.
So I'm going to just interject. Should be through the chair.
Okay.
So, yeah, no.
The last point I want to make, Mr. Chairman, to exemplify this, as I look at these pictures of all these people that are serving as judges now, if you're not a white man that's middle-aged, you're not even in here. I only, of the numbers that are there, I see one black person, one Malaysian person, and one Chinese person. And they're not even Alaska Native. And that's where I see there's no representation from the minority sector. And that's where I see what the problem is here, or one of the problems here.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's clearly not for lack of trying by the court system and by the judicial counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I mean, and actually, that kind of, you know, shows that there's a multifaceted element to this, and how do we bring Alaska into this? And I think it's been represented that that somehow, if you're a barred lawyer, that gives you a better view of Alaska or the system in Alaska. And I think that the public members deserve a lot more credit than they've been getting on their look into a system approach. So, you know, that's probably left more to the debate that we're going to have in the committee, not for you. And I know you have had to pretty much show up at the time where we're just about ready to debate this, and so you got most of the wind blown at your direction, and you have handled it well, Judge, so thank you very much. But you can see that the interest in our committee is how, number one, is it working with the kind of input that we would like to see from Alaska? So thank you very much for your time and your testimony. And I know, Senator Wilkowski, you had a question, and, you know, we're 40 minutes in, but I wanted to give you a chance to ask the Judicial Council a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if I could get the Executive Director of the Judicial Council up here, and then as soon as we answer that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to get Senator Kelly up here, very patiently waiting for the last 40 minutes for us to come to the place where he gets to speak. So thank you. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I'll be quick, maybe just about 5 minutes, if I could, of questions. And I was hoping, there's been a lot of talk about the rejections, the five or however many rejections there have been in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if we could just talk about those for a minute. And I don't want to name names. I don't want to sort of, you know, rehash people who didn't get nominated. But in October 2013, there was an opening for Fairbanks District Court. And my understanding is that three members were nominated, and there was a case where there was a tie. And my understanding is the person who was ultimately voted no by the Chief Justice had a lower score than those that were ultimately nominated or sent forward. Is that an accurate statement?
Through the chair, yes, that is an accurate statement. And of course, all of the bar survey scores are not the whole story. I think, as I might have mentioned in earlier testimony, they are correlated with better performance, higher likelihood of nomination, and better performance on the bench.
Okay. And then for the Alaska Supreme Court in December 2012, there were two names that were not forwarded. Ultimately, there were two names that were forwarded. And again, the scores for those that were forwarded were those that had fairly significantly higher scores than those that weren't forwarded. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, yes, I do believe that is fair to say.
And then in August 2012, Anchorage Superior Court, this is one that I think was mentioned before with a person who's been very active in litigating conservative causes. There were, let's see, one, two, three, four, five. There were five people that were forwarded on during that nomination. And my understanding is the person who was voted no, who we've spoken about, had one of the lowest scores. In fact, it was below acceptable score. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, yes. Some of the applicants are rated on six or five areas, and it is true that on at least a couple of those areas, the scores were below acceptable.
And the overall rating was
below acceptable
yes. Score. Okay. And then in Alaska Supreme Court, June 2012, that same person nominated once again got a score below acceptable. But then the others that were nominated, and I guess his name at that time didn't come up for a vote. There was no tie-breaking issue in that case, but there was a tie-breaking issue with someone else who ultimately was voted no and ultimately didn't go forward, and they had lower scores than the two people who were nominated. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, I do believe that's largely correct, yes.
And then August 2012, Bethel Superior Court, there was two names that were forwarded, and actually that was a tiebreaker, and the Chief Justice voted yes to forward the name on forward. Is that accurate?
Yes, through the chair, that's correct.
And then are you aware, just maybe to address some of Senator Olson's questions on the Native lawyers mm-hmm. putting their names forward, is that... I agree completely. I mean, I'd love to see more diversity on the court. Is there an issue that you're seeing or that you've seen in your studies with the lawyers or even the non-lawyers rejecting Native attorneys that are pushing? Do you even keep data like that?
We do keep a little bit of data on the nomination of Native attorneys, and they're a very small percentage of the bar. There are Native attorneys in the bar, but of course they have to want to be a judge and they have to apply, and there's not a big difference between the rate at which they apply and the rate at which they're nominated by the council. So it is what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Just one more question. I remember asking about the bar polling.
Yes.
That's done anonymously, and how broadly? I heard that there was people from out of state who can vote in that bar, and that there's no real requirement. So give me an idea of the percentage of people that are, say, on a list of potentials that actually respond.
So the bar survey is sent to attorneys. The address that the attorneys give to the Bar Association is their mailing address, and it's not necessarily their residence, so that's one little complication. But we do send surveys in selection to active members of the Alaska Bar Association. And, you know, I don't have and I think you were asking about the response rates.
Right.
And I'm sorry that I don't have that information right at the tip of my tongue, and I don't think that I would want to misspeak, but I can certainly get it for you.
And we spoke. I'm sorry. Yes, Senator Olson.
The inactive members that are roughly 2,000, do they not get a survey? You got 4,400 people that are on the bar.
Right.
2,000 of them are inactive. 2,200 are active.
Through the chair.
Do the inactive ones get a survey?
I could look that up for you. I'm sorry.
Oh,
because
right.
I'm new.
I have time.
I have it right here, but I can get it for you, yes. I just don't want to misspeak.
I don't want to slow you down.
Yeah. No.
One more quick question, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
One more quick question.
And
Senator Wilkowski.
This is in response to a statement that was made last week about defense attorneys giving prosecutors lower scores. I guess question number one, would that be ethical to do so? And number two, is that factually correct, or are there very many prosecutors on as judges?
Through the chair, actually, it would be unethical to make a false statement on the bar survey and to give an opinion about a prosecutor that was not the person's opinion about their skills. And actually, prosecutors are nominated at about the same rate at which they apply. And I put together a list. I was concerned about the statement, and I did put together a list of all the sitting judges who have had prosecutorial experience, and it's a very long list, and it goes to, I think, over 25 or 30 judicial officers currently sitting with prosecutorial experience.
Thank you. Thank you very much for spending the time with us, and thank you for the questions. We have kept the typers very busy putting together the discussion that we've put together on this, so there should be a pretty good body of discussion. With that, I would like to ask Senator Kelly if he would be willing to come up, and before we entertain the discussion on the bill, I wanted to have him get a chance to give his final look at it, and if he wanted to, give it your final statements, I would greatly appreciate it. So, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I wanted to tell a little anecdote here, as did Justice Carpinetti. Sorry, I think we're all going to call you Justice because we respect you.
Yes.
And we're very fond of your wife, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
She carries more weight in this room than you do, pal. And the anecdote is, at the risk of being a little too cute, is so this former justice testifies before the Judicial Committee in the Senate. And he gives an anecdote, and he says he's biased because he's been in the judiciary for 30 years. Well, the point is, the people that have testified, everybody here is biased. And the people that have testified have been part of the judicial system for years and years and years. And they're biased. They're good people. They produce for this state a decent product. Don't doubt that for a moment. The point is that we need to expand beyond that biased community, that it has too much sway in the selection of our of a branch of government, a very important branch, obviously. I have to tell you, too, as I've gone through this process of doing a constitutional amendment that affects the judiciary, I have not related, become very good friends with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Well, that gives you a new take on things when you become friends with that woman. She's an amazing jurist, obviously, and I respect her position. And she's her name is, we don't mention her name, but she comes up in this discussion, and it is with the same respect that we have for Justice Carpinetti that we have for her that we're really not talking about individuals. We're talking about a system that probably has a little flaw in it, and it's our job to discuss those and change them if we can. This morning, maybe another little anecdote, but not quite so clever. This morning we talked in finance about the number of people with felonies who won't be able to get jobs on the pipeline. And one of the things that came up was that in rural Alaska, there's a disproportionate number of felonies because of some of the things that Senator Olson was saying. There are a lot of Native people in jail for felonies. There are a lot of reasons for that. But as we looked forward, one of the things we wanted to do was make sure that the system wasn't stacked against them for getting a job financed in a major part by the state. And so we got into a brief discussion, but I think we need to iron this out a little more. It might be in SB 64 that we do it. We got to figure that out. People who are felons for reasons maybe that aren't... The circumstances of their incarceration aren't as dire, maybe, because they were involved in a $500 crime or something like that. We got to think about that as we're looking at the workforce that we're about to have to create to do this project. Well, why is it relevant to this? It's because that is how we look forward to see where people are disadvantaged in this state, and we change what we can if we can. This Constitution that chooses our judicial system, our judiciary, seems to have a flaw, and it precludes Native participation or certainly rural participation in the process that selects the judges. I don't think we can do much about the number of judges, and you were talking about that, Senator Olson, is the actual number of Native or rural judges. I think that's a long time coming because we're going to have, as Justice Carpinetti said, we're going to have more people entering law school, etc. But the fact is, we have a system that because the numbers are so small and the public members are so small, and because you're pulling the attorney members from an even tinier group of people, that rural Alaska is just kind of excluded, practically excluded. There's nothing in the Constitution that says thou shalt not appoint a rural or Native member to the Judicial Council. No, but when you only have three public members, and over time, when you got the major portion of the population in, you know, inhabiting just a couple of cities, that's kind of going to be where they come from, and rural Alaska kind of gets the shaft in the process. It's not that you don't have more judges. I don't know that we can do anything about that at this committee, but we can allow rural people to at least have a say in the process as we select the judiciary. Chief Justice also said that there were some reasons as stated in the sponsor statement that were the reasons for this constitutional amendment being brought forward by our office, sponsor statements aren't law. I mean, they don't carry that much weight in the record. The point is that I think I stated before this committee what our intention was with this constitutional amendment. Number one, we need regional diversification, and the number of public members is just too small to ever accomplish that. In that same reason is the fact that our Constitution is almost at conflict with itself. They didn't know this at the time when there was only 150,000 people in the state, or however many there were back then, that, you know, when you say in one part of the Section 8, Article 4, that you're only going to have three public members, and then a few lines later you say appointments shall be made with due consideration to area representation and without regard to political affiliation. They didn't know that they were putting themselves in conflict, that when the state grew, there would be this significant rural Alaskan voice that was not going to be heard because of the number of people they put in there. So we're going to expand that. Senator Olson, what you said about the tie that you take the Supreme Court justice out and then send it to the governor, frankly, I found that pretty interesting, and I wonder if we'll hear more about that as the process goes further. This committee already has amended the number in the CS. That's correct, right? Isn't it? Yes, and we welcome that as well. I don't want to take too much time, Mr. Chairman. There were just a couple of other things that I wanted to say, and that was going back to my my anecdote in the beginning that the Supreme Court justice, when they are forced into a situation of breaking a tie and siding with members of the bar or members of the public, they are in a conflict. They may strive in their life and in their training to be people who can maybe be a little better at dealing with conflicts. They would hope that. But the fact is, they're human beings. I now know the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. She's a human being. She's going to have conflicts. Math is going to go through her mind as she's making choices. It can't be avoided. So let's make the system just more fair. More fair so that the conflict is avoided, so that the people's representation on that judicial council has more sway than the Bar Association. Lastly, as I sat through testimony last week, over and over and over, people of the legal community were saying that we have a merit system and we should stick with it. Guess what? This constitutional amendment doesn't change our merit system. It's a very small change. And the testimony was as if we were throwing out the merit system. We're not. We're just improving on it, I think. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to take up any more time. I appreciate the work of this committee so far. I appreciate the very helpful language that was brought and put into the CS. As I said, we support that. And we will watch this as it goes through the process and ultimately let the people vote to see if they maybe should have a little more say, or at least shouldn't be excluded as they are in the current language of the Constitution. I would urge you all to vote for it. I would urge you, particularly as you vote, to keep in mind the people of rural Alaska. We got to get them into this conversation. They are excluded right now. They're practically excluded. I don't think there's anything malignant going on here at all. They're practically excluded, and that's good enough for me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A question from Senator Wilkowski for you.
Thank you. Would you support amendments to your bill to require that some of the people on the current membership are from rural Alaska?
I think the regional diversification meets that, and we can talk about it.
All right, that brings the discussion before us, so thank you, Senator. Unless there's another question to the sponsor, I tried to make my commitment to let you have your last say, and thank you for doing that. Thank you for the Senator and Heather for coming before us. That does bring the CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 21 before us. The will of the committee, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I move it, I just want to say that I appreciate all the discussion, but I trust the public. I also trust the judges. And I really think that increasing the number of public members is going to increase the opportunity for more of a diverse participation from rural Alaska. I feel a little bit badly because as one of the few women in the Senate, there are only four of us, I wish I would have spent a little bit more time, as Senator Olson did, bringing some of the statistics forward on the number of women. We don't have enough on the bench. It's something that I've pushed this governor to do, and he's done a yeoman's job of putting more on the bench, but it's been something that we have struggled as women to do, and so I'd like to see more women, frankly, on the Judicial Council as well. So this will give us a chance to have more diverse representation as a whole from all of the minority groups across the state. I don't think that we're going to suffer, with all respect, from knee-jerk reactions or political choices or a lack of competence. I trust the people of Alaska, and I don't think you have to have a Juris Doctorate degree to be able to look at those choices in front of you and recognize competence. I do think that the three attorneys that are there will continue to serve as an excellent resource. We've heard that from those who have served on the Judicial Council, that they have leaned heavily on those three attorneys as a resource, and I'm sure they're going to continue to do so. So with that, unless others, if, are there others that want to make comments before I make a motion?
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you want me to make comments now or after the motion, Mr. Chair?
Well, actually, I prefer a motion.
Okay.
So let's go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move out of this committee the CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 21, / N with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
I'll object.
All right.
For purposes of discussion, at least.
All right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess there's generally three types of ways that you can pick judges. You can have judges who are elected. You can have judges who are appointed by the chief executive, the governor, or you can have a hybrid plan like we have, which is known as the Missouri plan. And I think if you go back and look at the constitutional minutes, what you see is the constitutional delegates clearly rejected gubernatorial appointments because they didn't want to politicize the process. You see a lot of testimony from people talking about how this is how they do it in other states, and it's just too highly politicized. And so there was clearly an intent by the constitutional delegates not to politicize this process, and I think that was the right thing to do by not having an election. Now, for a similar reason, they rejected a gubernatorial appointment. And so you didn't want an election because you don't want judges out there having to campaign, having to raise funds, having to go out and make promises to people, making decisions. So they clearly wanted to remove the politics from that. They clearly wanted to remove the politics from a gubernatorial appointee. And so they came up with this plan, which is known as the Missouri plan. It's crafted after Missouri. There's a number of states that do it. And what it does is you have a number of people who are appointed by the governor. You have a number of people who are members of the bar. And then you have, in Alaska's case, a chief justice that breaks the tie. Is it unusual that you have a chief justice that breaks the tie? No. In fact, if you look at the way we do the redistricting board, something that probably many of you supported and voted for just a number, that was probably back in 2000. That was the tiebreaker. That's how we decided how we're going to select the fifth person on the redistricting board. You have someone appointed by the Speaker of the House, someone appointed by the President, two people appointed by the Governor. They're all political appointees, and if there's a tie, you have the Chief Justice who appoints someone. This is not novel that we have the Chief Justice, someone that we respect in this community, and you can see the respect that we have for, and I'm still going to call him Justice Carpinetti. I called him that the other day, and he yelled at me. I'm still going to call you Justice Carpinetti because we have tremendous respect for you, and we have tremendous respect for that position. And the reason we respect that position is because Alaska's judiciary is one of the best in the country.
Yes.
It probably is the best in the country. And what you see is you have other states where they have judiciaries that are very heavily politicized. You have people who are friends with the governor, people who raise money for the governor, getting appointed. That's just the wrong way to do it. That's not how we do it in Alaska. That's not how we should do it in Alaska. And my concern and the fear that I have is this process, when you take that away, whether you take away the Supreme Court justice who is beyond reproach, his ability, her ability to break any ties, when you tip the favor in favor of judicial appointees to a judicial council by the governor, what you are doing is you are politicizing the process. Even if you have a 3-3 tie and you say, well, if it's a tie, we're just going to send it up to the Supreme Court, you still have a process where the gubernatorial appointees are making the decision. And that's not the process that we want. That's the process that our founders rejected. That's the process that we've lived with for 50-plus years and has worked great. the best judicial system in the country. And, you know, there's a saying, Mr. President, we've heard it over and over and over again, if it's not broke, don't fix it. This system is not broke. We shouldn't fix it. And so how do we know it's not broke? Well, you can look at the numbers, and we can see. This is a system that has resulted in 30 years and probably a heck of a lot more votes before that, 1,136 votes in 30 plus years. 15 times, Mr. Chair, 15 times in that time have you had a split, an even split between the attorneys and the non-attorneys. 15 times, less than 1%. This is not a system that's broke. And whether it's 9 times or 10 times that the Supreme Court justice has cited, you're not seeing a clear instance where the Supreme Court justice is siding on one side or another. You're seeing a very careful deliberation. And you can see, and that's why I wanted to call the Judicial Council up and ask her some questions that I had today, because what you saw was, you know, we've heard a lot of hyperbole about, well, they're just siding with the attorneys and there's really no rational basis. There's a rational basis for every single one of their votes in the last 5 years. Every single one that was rejected by the Supreme Court justice was a vote where the person had scored demonstrably lower than everyone else. This is a merit-based system. We want the people who ultimately become judges to be the best judges, the highest scoring judges. And we've heard testimony from the Judicial Council about how those who score well tend to get nominated. Those who score well tend to do better on their retention scores. We want high-scoring judges, Mr. Chair, and that's exactly what we're getting. That's exactly why we have the best judiciary system in the United States. We shouldn't be changing. And there were some comments made last week about how, for instance, members of the defense bar routinely or unethically reject prosecutors. It's just demonstrably false. It's if not true, and we know that because we heard testimony today. First of all, it would be unethical for someone to give another person a rating that was not accurate. But second of all, there's 32 prosecutors who are sitting on the bench today, 32 people on the bench today who have prosecutorial experience. There is not some sort of conspiracy out there to deny prosecutors from being on the bar. That's not the way it works. That's not what's happening. That's not what's happening. And so I want to close by addressing the issue of does this help rural Alaska? I mean, there's been this point made that this somehow helps rural Alaska, and I appreciate the concerns that we want to have a fair bench that takes into consideration the concerns of those in rural Alaska, that takes into consideration the concerns of Native Alaskans. I think that's of paramount importance, and it shouldn't just be Native Alaskans. It should be women. It should be minorities. We need to have a more diverse bar. We need to have a more diverse judiciary. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But this does nothing to change it. This bill, this resolution, does nothing to change it. In fact, if you look at the bill, already in law, already in Section 8 of Article 4, Section 8, Judicial Council, it already says appointments shall be made with due consideration to area representation. It already says that in the Constitution. We're not doing anything to increase the ability to elect people from rural Alaska, to select people from rural Alaska. We're not doing anything about that. And that's probably the reason, Mr. Chair, why the Alaska Federation of Natives, those that represent many people in rural Alaska, those that represent natives here in Alaska, unanimously oppose this resolution. That's why they've come out so strongly in opposition to this. This does nothing to help rural Alaska. There's nothing currently that prohibits a governor from appointing people from rural Alaska. It's not our fault that the governor has not chosen people from rural Alaska in the last 6 years that he's been in office, or his predecessor in the 2 years before that, or Governor Murkowski in the 4 years before that. I can't control that. The governor is responsible for nominating people. We should strive to get more people from rural Alaska, but that's the governor's job, and the governor hasn't met that job. We shouldn't change the Constitution because the governor's not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I oppose this, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity, the leeway that you've given it to allow me to ask questions, and I think this will fundamentally alter the judiciary here in Alaska in a way that will not benefit the people of this state, and in particular the people of rural Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments before we take a vote? So, as the chairman of the committee, I'm going to vote in favor of moving this bill. I think you're right that the process of getting representation from rural Alaska has struggled, and it was also said from Justice Carpinetti and the Judicial Council that it's really the pool to draw from that is going to be something that we're all going to have to work on. And so, and diversity and qualification, in my view, have to kind of travel together. And so I think what this does is it gives the public a better opportunity to be appointed in. I think that's going to be a good thing. I think to say that knowing the legal community is more important than having public input has some real credible arguments to it. But I think the other side of it is going to be that because the judiciary has become more and more active in so many areas, having more public input into it is going to be very, very valuable. So I'm going to support more non-attorney members. And through the testimony, some of the people indicated that they would be more prone to everything from lack of knowledge to scandals. And that I found that unfortunate because human nature being what it is, we're all going to live with that. I've seen it here in politics. I've seen it in the judiciary. I've seen it outside the judiciary. So to think that one group of people is more prone to it than others, I do not buy. It is true they have a direct knowledge of the action, but it's also true that those who are kind of doing the interviewing get to have the input from those groups of people. And I think I heard from many members, pro and con, on the Judicial Council who are public members, who said that they were giving huge amounts of reading material and were able to ask questions. I find that the interchange of ideas to be very valuable. So whether there's more public members or not on this, I think that information change is valuable, needs to be important. But I think having more public members gives you more opportunity at this point to kind of bring the public along with you. And I can tell you, just as a citizen myself, this is a mystery to many of us in the world, what goes on and how judges come to be. And I think having public members come in is going to be more important. I think they can be just as thorough and just as fair as any member of the Bar Association. So I find that that is not a compelling enough argument for me that they would be more fair or just or free from the inability, I should say, of looking at the merit of the people. Having the ability to look at legal writing certainly has its benefit from the lawyers who actually have to write and try cases. For that, I am grateful, and I think that it's a valuable part of the Judicial Council, from what I've understood. Looking at the temperament of judges, though, I don't think should be the exclusive right of those who have to work within them. I think looking at their track record can be done by public members. The respect for the Constitution comes in a lot of different ways. We do have a very good judiciary, but as I said to one person, it didn't come down in tables of stones. It came down through men who had to work through their time in history, and we're working through our time in history. Many, many amendments have happened to the Constitution. They actually stated one of the concepts was that political power is inherent in the people. And I think giving them the opportunity to have input into the selection of judges at a greater level in our time in history is probably a good thing. Then, and I've mentioned it before, and I guess it is one of the things that troubled me, was that sitting as a member here as an elected person, that somehow political policy decisions always have to be less than noble. I find that troubling. I find that lawyers can go through their own kind of politically correct problems, but I do not disparage them, their opinion, nor their ability to have, even within their own selves, their own kind of political problems. But to think that within those political problems, it's always going to be less than noble, I don't find that as a compelling enough argument for me to say that having people from the public is they're more prone to politics than, say, members of the Bar Association. I reject that out of hand. many of us have to go and campaign. That is true, and we do it very nobly. And I think the people have to select people that they think are noble and willing to serve them. To think that somehow a political policy that is either contentious, social, moral, legal-based, somehow because you have an opinion is less than noble, I just reject. I think that people are people. You have noble and less than noble people. And I think that the people who, under this condition, are non-attorney members could rise to that occasion. And indeed, from the testimony I've seen here, have risen to that occasion. So impugning people's motives, I don't know that I would do that at this point. However, as a seated member of the legislature, I have actually seen people who carry a barred license who say that they will treat their own members with the utmost respect and ethical behavior, treat members of the public with less than that nobleness. And so it has been troubling to me, and witnessing that from the legislative perspective makes me think that maybe it is more policy-driven than it should be. And so with that, I think even more so, it makes me want to go to more non-attorney members to bring that public perspective into what could look like a cartel-like operation. And so, and that is probably as pejorative as I'm going to get, because what I've said before, and I meant it seriously, it's a mystery to many of us. And so that's why it kind of ends up thinking about that. We're in the public arena. It's a very open process. Even the Bar Council, when they are asking people, they ask them in confidence, and rightfully so probably, but the public members don't get that benefit. And the public members bring probably a much more rigorous process, at least from my perspective, to now what would be the ability to say who is going to sit judge on the people of Alaska. So with that, I'm going to ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a couple of comments first? Well, first of all, the public has a profound mistrust of lawyers in general, and rightly so. And because I think what's happened is that as you look at the history of the judiciary here in the territory of the Asian, you go back to the 1960s, where disciplinary action against the lawyers that were in the community, there was this big fight between Bill Nesbitt and the rest of the bar, which unfortunately Harry Aaron was non-retained in the last situation. He had nothing to do with it. And then George Boney comes on, and we got all this situation. So there's stuff going on. There's all kinds of problems with it. We all see them. But it still is our constitution. And I think we've got some good things, we've got some bad things. I think this, I'd like to have more time so we could try and amend this thing so we could address the situation that has been talked about by Senator Walikowski about getting more rural representation either on either sector. So I'd like to amend it if we possibly could, but we don't, in the consideration of time, I see that as
this is this first committee report.
Unlikely. With that, Mr. Chairman, I close my comments.
This is this first committee referral, and I wanted to have an honest debate as we could, knowing that tensions would rise as much as possible because, first of all, many people are challenged. The judiciary and many of the things that they do are challenged. The public and many of the things they do are challenged. And quite frankly, it's tough to change what people who we assign a lot of wisdom to and putting our Constitution together, and I take that very personally as my dad was part of that. With that, what I'm going to do is call for a vote. So why don't we call the roll?
Senator McGuire?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator
Olson? No.
Senator Walikowski?
No.
Chair Coghill?
Yes.
3 yeas, 2 nays.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the time to take in consideration this. And as I said, it's got a journey to go. So with that, Senate Joint Resolution 21 amended goes from committee to its next committee referral, which will be the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, yes. Just for the record, when I checked on basis, it did not have a Finance Committee referral, and it's got a fiscal note. I think it does need one. You and I talked about this, and I mentioned I would put it on the record. So,
And it does have a fiscal note, so it will be traveling with the accompanying fiscal note. Every legislative request to change the Constitution is going to go with this fiscal note, because you're going to have it on the ballot, and it's going to have much process. So with that, the CS for Joint Resolution 21 passes as amended with an attached fiscal note. Thank you very much. I'll take a brief at ease. Online, and the next thing that I thought we'd do is go ahead and bring up the Ethics Committee confirmation hearings. And Christina Williams hung in there, and obviously you testified on the last bill that we heard and did a good job. Christina, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Thank you very much for hanging in there with us. And, of course, you were probably interested in the testimony as much as anybody. Why don't you go ahead and just put yourself on record, introduce yourself, and give us what you would hope to do while serving on the Ethics Committee.
Okay. My name is Christina Williams, and I am by profession a journalist, and I've served, as you gathered a couple days ago when I testified, I've served the state on the Alaska Judicial Council, and I just believe in public service. I serve on the local hospital board, and I was asked whether I would consider serving on the ethics board, and that is something that would appeal to me, and I just believe as an Alaskan that I should volunteer some of my time to do my part for Alaska. So that's why I'm sitting here waiting all this time.
Serving already.
Christina, I surely appreciate that. Have you had a chance to serve on an ethics committee prior to this?
I have not.
Okay. It's a very interesting issue, and our ethics laws have some very interesting portions to them. And of course it's a result of years of discussion in the Ethics Committee, and I got to serve on that. So you are in for a very interesting discussion, I can tell you that. Is there any questions for Christina, any comments at this point? My goodness, we kept you online, and people are willing to pass along. I know that, have you had a chance to listen in on any of the ethics committees to date? I think some of them are publicly available.
Actually, I traveled to Juneau in January and attended one of the ethics board meetings then.
If you ever want to hear an interesting discussion, Christina, come to one of the first legislative hearings when new members are elected and they are laid out what the ethics requirements are. I think one of the things you'll find is the first thing they feel is affronted, because ethics laws generally are very prescriptive, and many times they feel like they're being charged as unethical until proven ethical, and it's a very interesting feeling for a new legislator to come into this world of ethical behavior. So
right.
I think you're going to find for an interesting discussion. So if you ever get the opportunity to attend one of the ethics classes that are now required by new legislators, if you get confirmed, which my expectation will happen, you'll get your opportunity next January. So I would encourage you to do that.
Okay, well, I will try to do that.
Is there any further discussion with Christina? Just as the chairman, I want to thank you for your input in the previous bill, your willingness to speak up, always greatly appreciated. your willingness to serve here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the members if there's any objection to forwarding her name to the full body. With that, Christina, thank you very much for willing to serve and your patience on sitting through our lengthy discussion in committee. Thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And what I'm going to do at this point, I'm going to hold that over until I get Janie Lake. I'm going to have to get that practice before she gets here. And that way we'll forward both names at the same time. Is that all right with you guys?
Mm-hmm.
All right. With that, thank you, committee members, for your very thoughtful discussion. Appreciate it very much so. And with that, we'll call this committee adjourned.